In each of the preceding three lectures in this course, we looked at the Supreme Court's response to the most divisive and difficult issue that confronted the nation during the 19th century, the issue of race. We focused on several landmark cases that involved the institution of human slavery and the regime of racial segregation that followed the abolition of slavery. We'll return to the issue of race in several of our following lectures and look at the court's decisions in cases that involve school segregation, affirmative action, and other racial issues. We're going to shift in this lecture from a chronological approach to the court's major rulings and take a biographical approach. We'll examine the careers and judicial philosophies of two of the most influential justices in the court's entire history, Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis Dembitz Brandeis. Their service on the court spanned the first four decades of the 20th century. Holmes joined the court in 1902, and Brandeis took his seat in 1916. The two justices served together for 16 years, until Holmes retired in 1932, while Brandeis remained on the court until his retirement in 1939. There's very little dispute in saying that Holmes and Brandeis are ranked among the greatest justices in the court's history. Every listing of great justices includes these two men, even by scholars who differ sharply on which other justices belong in the judicial pantheon. This raises the fascinating question of how we measure judicial greatness. Before we turn to Holmes and Brandeis, it's worth looking at the attributes that scholars have considered in ranking justices as great, near great, competent, or as failures on the court. One of these attributes is longevity. Supreme Court justices enjoy life tenure in their positions, and they remain on the bench until they resign or retire or die. And the longer one serves, the more likely it becomes that a justice will write many opinions and gain the notice of historians. Measured on this scale, 38 of the 110 justices who have served on the court from 1790 until the present had tenures of 20 years or more. That's slightly more than a third of all the justices. And 13 justices, from Bushrod Washington through William Rehnquist, have served for 30 years or longer. But longevity on the bench is no guarantee of judicial greatness. Hardly anyone today remembers such justices as William Johnson, John McLean, or James Wayne, who each sat on the court for more than 30 years during the 19th century. And of the 16 men who have served as Chief Justice, the first three had a combined tenure of only 8 years. Two notable Chief Justices, Salmon Chase and William Howard Taft, each headed the court for just 9 years. Another attribute that historians consider as a mark of judicial greatness is literary style in writing opinions. There's no doubt that Oliver Wendell Holmes was the best writer in the court's history. As we'll see, Holmes came from a literary family, and no justice ever coined more memorable phrases in his opinions. And Chief Justice John Marshall put his strong views into forceful words. But other justices who are ranked among the greatest, such as Joseph Story and Stephen Field, wrote opinions that lacked any literary flair or polish. In recent decades, few Supreme Court opinions have shown much literary quality, as footnotes outweigh the text and citations to earlier cases pile up. Judicial greatness does not depend on philosophical consistency or clarity. Holmes, again, is an example of a great justice whose views shifted over time, as we'll see in the opinions he wrote in free speech cases. Many Supreme Court justices, both liberal and conservative in philosophy, have been consistent throughout their careers, but have taken inflexible positions that reflect their rigid political ideologies. James McReynolds on the right, William O. Douglas on the left, are examples of justices who wrote their political views into their judicial opinions. At the other extreme, many justices never articulated a consistent judicial philosophy, and their opinions lack any doctrinal anchor. Potter Stewart, who retired in 1981 after 23 years on the court, is an example of a justice who decided cases more on his gut feelings than any consistent approach to the Constitution. I think it's fair to conclude that no single attribute can explain judicial greatness. The justices who have been ranked by historians among the greatest in the court's history have different attributes and have read the Constitution in very different ways. Justices Holmes and Brandeis, as we'll see, had very different backgrounds and judicial philosophies. But each man had that hard-to-define quality that stamps him as a great justice. Perhaps the best way to put it is the great justices, much like great men and women in other fields, are engaged with the great issues of their times. This is not the same as having strong convictions or possessing a forceful personality. But engagement requires both experience and reflection. And for judges, it demands an awareness that hard cases do not allow easy decisions. In this respect, both Holmes and Brandeis belong to the short list of great justices. We'll look first at Holmes, who was born in 1841 into an illustrious Boston family, whose roots went back on both sides to the first settlers in this country. His father, Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., first trained at Harvard to become a lawyer, but switched to medicine and became a prominent physician with a keen interest in medical history. He was also a celebrated poet and essayist, whose best-known book had the revealing title of The Autocrat of the Breakfast Table. Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., known as Wendell, studied Latin and Greek at a private academy before he entered Harvard College in 1857. His family was abolitionist and solidly Republican, and Holmes backed Abraham Lincoln for president in 1860. When the Civil War began in April 1861, Holmes was nearing graduation and had planned to begin law studies at Harvard. But he immediately joined what became known as the Harvard Regiment and entered combat within weeks of his posting to the Potomac River near Washington. In one of the bloodiest early battles of the war, at Ball's Bluff in Virginia, Holmes was gravely wounded in the chest. After recuperating at home in Boston, Holmes returned to his regiment and fought in the Battle of Antietam in Maryland, where 20,000 young men died. A few weeks later, Holmes was shot in the neck and again returned home to recuperate. He returned to battle again and was wounded once more before he was mustered out as a captain in July of 1864. There's no doubt that Holmes was profoundly affected by his wartime experience, the slaughter he witnessed, and his own serious wounds in battle. In later years, Holmes did not recoil from war as a pacifist. Neither did he revel in war as a jingoist. His response to the war, and his own close brushes with death, made him, I think, a thoroughgoing skeptic and fatalist. Holmes lost any faith in the perfectibility of human nature and society, in the inevitability of social and economic progress, and in the rightness of what he called the fighting faiths that lead to crusades and conquests. But his skepticism did not prompt Holmes to retreat from public life. He later expressed his approach to life in these words: "Life is action and passion. Therefore, it is required of a man that he should share the passion and action of his time at peril of being judged not to have lived." Holmes brought this philosophy to his law practice in Boston, which he combined with teaching at Harvard until he joined the Massachusetts Supreme Court in 1882. Holmes served in that court for 20 years, the last 10 as Chief Justice. He also became a prolific and illustrious legal scholar. In 1881, Holmes published a series of lectures at Harvard as a book called The Common Law, in which he deplored the rigid formalism of legal doctrine. Holmes put his views into a memorable sentence: "The life of the law has not been logic, it has been experience." He looked to what he called the felt necessities of the times for guidance in deciding cases, rather than political or economic dogma. But as much as Holmes deplored the rigidity of legal doctrine, he also distrusted the ability of the common people to make wise political and economic choices. Holmes once told a judicial colleague that, "When the people want to do something that I can't find anything in the Constitution expressly forbidding them to do, I say, whether I like it or not, God damn it, let them do it. In simple terms, Holmes was expressing the view of judicial restraint, of deferring to legislative judgment unless the Constitution stood directly in the way. Holmes brought this philosophy to the Supreme Court in 1902, when he was named by President Theodore Roosevelt at the age of 61. Roosevelt admired Holmes as a brave soldier and a respected state judge. But after Holmes voted against the president's position in a major antitrust case, Roosevelt wrote of his bitter disappointment in placing him on the court. On his part, Holmes dismissed the president as a man of shallow intellect. Roosevelt shared Holmes's action and passion, but not his commitment to judicial independence. We'll take a closer look in later lectures at some of the opinions in which Holmes expressed two aspects of his judicial philosophy, those of deference to lawmakers in economic regulation cases and of adherence to constitutional prohibitions in free speech cases. But it's worth quoting here from two opinions in which Holmes applied his philosophy, both in dissent. In the landmark case of Lochner versus New York in 1905, the court struck down a state limit on the working hours of bakers. Holmes wrote in his dissenting opinion that, as he put it, a constitution is not intended to embody a particular economic theory. It is made for people of fundamentally differing views. Holmes added these words to his Lochner dissent. I strongly believe that my agreement or disagreement has nothing to do with the right of a majority to embody their opinion in law. In contrast, Holmes did not defer to majority opinion in cases that involve free speech rights under the First Amendment. On this subject, his views changed over time. Holmes had written opinions that upheld criminal convictions for opposing military conscription during World War I, in which he developed the famous clear and present danger test. But he soon realized that this test gave the government too much power to punish opinions it considered subversive or seditious. His change of heart was best expressed in an opinion he wrote in 1929. In a case that involved a German immigrant named Rosika Schwimmer, who had applied for American citizenship. Federal law required applicants to swear that they would bear arms to defend the country. Schwimmer was a Quaker who called herself an uncompromising pacifist. She told a hearing officer that, I am willing to do everything that an American citizen has to do except fighting. I am not willing to bear arms. Holmes dissented from the court's ruling that Congress could bar pacifists from citizenship. He looked at Rosika Schwimmer from his own perspective, as a soldier who had witnessed the horrors of battle, but who also believed that war was necessary to save the Union. Schwimmer's pacifist views might excite popular prejudice, Holmes wrote, but they did not disqualify her from citizenship. He put his philosophy in these ringing words. If there is any principle of the Constitution that more imperatively calls for attachment more than any other, it is the principle of free thought. Not free thought for those who agree with us, but freedom for the thought that we hate. In my view, Holmes's opinions in the Lochner and Schwimmer cases provide an insight into his judicial greatness. He recognized that the Constitution was, as he wrote, made for people of fundamentally differing views. When those differences involve economic regulation, the majority has a right to put its opinions into law. But the Constitution erects a barrier when majorities use their power to punish those whose beliefs excite popular prejudice against them. But even great justices make mistakes. Before we turn to Justice Louis Brandeis, it's instructive to look briefly at a case in which Holmes deferred to a legislative judgment that inflicted a severe punishment on a young woman whose only crime was moral delinquency. This is the case of Carrie Buck, who was committed in the 1920s to the Virginia State Colony for the epileptic and feeble-minded. Now, Carrie's mother had been an inmate of the colony, and Carrie was the mother of an illegitimate child. The colony's director asked the state judge to authorize her sterilization to prevent her from becoming pregnant again. Carrie had also been labeled as feeble-minded without any testing of her intelligence. Virginia was one of 30 states that had passed what were called eugenic sterilization laws, and Carrie became the unwitting test case of the law's constitutionality. In his opinion for the court upholding the law, Holmes recited the lower court's finding that Carrie is the probable potential parent of socially inadequate offspring, a judicial euphemism for illegitimacy. Holmes's opinion in the case of Buck versus Bell reflected both his wartime experiences and his aristocratic disdain for the lower classes. He put his views in these harsh words: "We have seen more than once that the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sapped the strength of the state for these lesser sacrifices in order to prevent our being swamped with incompetence. It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. Three generations of imbeciles are enough." Holmes revealed a personal and philosophical blind spot in this opinion, in my view, one that reflected both his Brahmin upbringing and his educational grounding in Plato's ideal society of aristocratic guardians of public morality. Holmes also displayed, in a number of cases, an attitude toward blacks and other racial minorities that one biographer called a consciousness based on white supremacy. In this regard, Holmes shared the prejudices of most white Americans of his class. His only contacts with poor whites and blacks were his servants. Even his Civil War regiment was largely composed of Harvard students and graduates like himself. This insulation from the social reality of poverty and racism led his close friend, Louis Brandeis, to tell Holmes that he knew nothing about the evils that created suffering for much of the population. Brandeis knew a great deal about the evils of society. He devoted his legal practice to combating the evils of sweatshops, price gouging, and monopolies. Brandeis came to the law and to Boston from a middle-class upbringing in Louisville, Kentucky, where he was born in 1856. His family was Jewish, but not religiously observant, although Brandeis remained firmly attached to his cultural roots and became an active supporter of the Zionist movement. He graduated at the top of his class at Harvard Law School in 1877 and entered practice in Boston. From the very beginning of his legal career, Brandeis combined a deep social consciousness with a focus on the facts of the cases he handled. He once wrote that nobody can form a judgment that is worth having without a fairly detailed and intimate knowledge of the facts. And he drew the facts he used in trials and legal briefs from a wide range of sources: medical journals, government reports, historical materials. Holmes once told a friend, "The way that cuss is loaded with facts on all manner of subjects leaves me gawping." Brandeis looked beyond the facts of the case before him, both as a lawyer and a justice, to the social and economic context in which they arose. The best example of Brandeis's approach to the law comes from a case he argued in 1908 before the Supreme Court, a case called Muller versus Oregon. Brandeis was defending an Oregon law that set maximum working hours for women who worked in laundries. He submitted a brief to the Supreme Court that included just 2 pages of legal analysis, but it was packed with more than 100 pages of excerpts from medical and sociological reports that documented the damaging effects of long hours on the health of women workers. Brandeis won the Muller case, and the court's opinion cited with approval what it called the very copious material in his brief. This approach became known as the Brandeis brief and was emulated by lawyers in many later cases. Brandeis gained a national reputation as the people's lawyer, and his record impressed President Woodrow Wilson for whom Brandeis had actively campaigned in 1912. Wilson named Brandeis to the Supreme Court in 1916, and his nomination sparked a bitter partisan battle in the Senate. The opposition to Brandeis outside the Senate was led by William Howard Taft, a former Republican president who wanted the post for himself. Taft was one of six former American Bar Association presidents who signed a letter to the Senate that read, "Taking into view the reputation, character, and professional career of Mr. Louis D. Brandeis, he is not a fit person to be a member of the Supreme Court of the United States." The conservative attack on Brandeis had nothing to do with his character or legal abilities. It had everything to do with his liberal politics and his defense of consumers and workers. And there was a strong whiff of anti-Semitism in the campaign to keep Brandeis from becoming the first Jew on the Supreme Court. But the Senate confirmed him by a vote of 47 to 22, almost strictly on party lines. Ironically, Taft became Chief Justice in 1921 and served for 9 years with a man whose nomination to the court he had called an evil and a disgrace that ought to be avoided. After he joined the court, Brandeis had the opportunity to put into his judicial opinions the views he had expressed forcefully as the people's lawyer. Perhaps the best illustrations of Brandeis's philosophy are found in the titles of two books he wrote, Other People's Money and The Curse of Bigness. In the first book, Brandeis levied an indictment of banks and insurance companies, charging that they contributed nothing essential to the economy, but used other people's money to enrich themselves. The Curse of Bigness, which was published in 1934, deplored the galloping centralization of power in corporations and the federal government. It was really a warning to the New Deal administration of President Franklin Roosevelt that the virtual marriage of business and government posed a threat to workers and voters. In fact, Brandeis voted in 1935 to strike down the legislative centerpiece of Roosevelt's New Deal program, the National Industrial Recovery Act. This law allowed business groups to set prices and production quotas in more than 1,000 industries. Brandeis was so concerned about corporate influence in Washington that he called in one of Roosevelt's advisors, a young lawyer named Thomas Corcoran, known as Tommy the Cork. "This is the end of this business of centralization," Brandeis told Corcoran. "I want you to go back and tell the president that we're not going to let this government centralize everything." The alternative to federal centralization, as Brandeis viewed the economic system and government, lay in the states. He was a firm advocate of letting the states serve as laboratories for experiments in social and economic regulation. Brandeis put his views into a dissenting opinion in a case decided in 1932 called New State Ice Company versus Liebman. In this case, the Oklahoma legislature had responded to cutthroat competition in the state's ice business by banning the entry of any new firms into the business. At that time, electric refrigerators were expensive, and most people used block ice for cooling food. The Supreme Court struck down the law, holding that the sale of ice was not so essential to the public that Oklahoma could ban companies from entering the business. Now, Brandeis was a strong advocate of business competition, but in this case, he looked at the impact of the Great Depression, which had prompted so much price slashing that many small businesses shut their doors. If Oklahoma felt that limiting competition in the ice business would serve the public interest, Brandeis would let the state try this approach. He stated his position in these words: "It is one of the happy incidents of the federal system that a single courageous state may, if its citizens choose, serve as a laboratory and try novel social and economic experiments without risk to the rest of the country. It was the practical effect of the state law, rather than any rigid legal doctrine, that influenced Brandeis in this case and in similar economic regulation cases." Brandeis ended his dissent in the New State Ice case with these words: "If we would guide by the light of reason, we must let our minds be bold." he displayed this boldness of thought more than 40 years earlier in an article he wrote for the Harvard Law Review in 1890. The title of this article was The Right to Privacy. Now, we tend to associate this phrase today with the court's rulings in the 1960s and 70s in cases that involved contraception and abortion. But the phrase and the concept behind it had their origins more than a century ago in this path-breaking article. Brandeis was not concerned with birth control or abortion. The privacy he wanted to protect was that of people whose pictures were used without their permission in advertisements or whose private lives were sensationalized in the tabloid newspapers of the time. Brandeis proposed in his article that lawmakers provide legal remedies for what he called the evil of the invasion of privacy by the newspapers. But his article had a broader focus. Brandeis wanted to show that a right of privacy was the outgrowth of changes in the legal concepts of life, liberty, and property. He put his thesis in these words. Political, social, and economic changes entail the recognition of new rights, and the common law, in its eternal youth, grows to meet the demands of society. Brandeis noted that law once protected only a person's body and physical property against harm. But in a gradual process, Brandeis wrote, the scope of these legal rights broadened, and now the right to life has come to mean the right to enjoy life, the right to be let alone. It's important to note that Brandeis defined the right to enjoy life as the right to be let alone. And he meant to be let alone by the government, to be free from unwarranted intrusion into such aspects of life, as he said, family relations and intellectual and emotional life. As we saw, Brandeis wrote his article on the right to privacy in 1890. But its concepts and even its wording turned up in several opinions Brandeis wrote as a Supreme Court justice. The best example is his dissenting opinion in Olmstead v. United States, a case decided in 1928. The court's majority upheld the federal government's power to secure evidence in criminal cases through telephone wiretaps without a judicial warrant. Brandeis pointed to the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable searches and seizures and its requirement for warrants. The makers of our Constitution, Brandeis wrote, conferred, as against the government, the right to be let alone, the most comprehensive of rights and the right most valued by civilized men. Brandeis conceded that the wiretaps had produced evidence of criminal activity, in this case of bookmaking. But, he added, experience should teach us to be most on our guard when the government's purposes are beneficent. Men born to freedom are naturally alert to repel invasion of their liberty by evil-minded rulers. But the greatest dangers to liberty lurk in insidious encroachment by men of zeal, well-meaning but without understanding. These are important, even prophetic words. But it's worth noting that Brandeis had joined, only 1 year before he wrote those words, Justice Holmes' opinion in Carrie Buck's case, upholding the acts of well-meaning men who authorized and performed her sterilization. In our brief examination of two justices who left a lasting impact on the court and on American law, I think we could describe Oliver Wendell Holmes as the last of the great common law justices and Louis Brandeis as the first of the great statutory law justices. Holmes distrusted the common man, while Brandeis had faith in his fellow citizens. Holmes rarely discussed the facts of a case in his opinions, while Brandeis looked first to the facts in deciding cases. But as different as they were, both Holmes and Brandeis showed a passion for the law and a boldness of mind that made them great justices. We'll look in the following two lectures at some of the cases involving economic regulation and freedom of speech, in which Holmes and Brandeis put these qualities into their opinions, most often in dissent.